Hello and welcome to the Contracting Officer Podcast. Our mission, to make government contracting better, one contract at a time. Whether you work for government or industry, we're here to help you understand a little more about how the other side thinks. Today's episode is sponsored by ProPricer, the number one proposal pricing and cost analysis software used by federal agencies and small to large government contractors. Hey, Kevin, did you know that ProPricer is not just for defense contractors?
When I was a contracting officer, I did not know that ProPricer had a government edition.
ProPricer's government edition helps federal agencies save an enormous amount of time and simplify their cost analysis process.
Yeah, I used to spend days building spreadsheets from scratch to compare offers, pricing, data, and manual.
Now, in just a few clicks, ProPricer can seamlessly import contractor cost data into a secure database environment and compare that data across multiple cost proposals.
Back when I was a contracting officer, I had to become a black belt in Excel to analyze these pricing data.
ProPricer offers lots of other great features, like offer or cost normalizing, custom reporting, and what-if analysis.
And the government folks can buy ProPricer directly off the GSA site.
To learn more about ProPricer and help keep our podcast free, visit ProPricer.com/podcast. While you're there, request a product demo to see how ProPricer can help your organization. This week we have a special guest as Kevin interviews Garth Arevalo, CEO of Lucos LLC and a former contracting officer himself. This is part one of the interview where Kevin and Garth discuss the perspectives they've gained since moving to the industry side and the top three things they wish they had known when they were contracting officers. You'll also learn what happens when I turn Kevin loose with a mic and a laptop, so apologies in advance for the echoey audio. All right, let's get started.
Welcome to the Contracting Officer Podcast. Today it's just me. This is Kevin. Don't freak out. Paul is sitting this one out because while I was able to set up an in-person interview here in Tampa with a really great guest, it's my friend and colleague in this business, Garth Arevalo. Garth and I have been friends for a long time. I'm excited to have him on here. He's the CEO of Lucos LLC. He's also a former contracting officer just like me. In fact, we were contracting officers together at Special Operations Command, you know, back in the day, a few years ago. In 2008, he left his position as a contingency contracting officer at Special Operations Command to start Lucos. He's a mentor and friend of mine for several years. We've even worked together on several projects together since leaving government. We even helped him win Seaport E and some other successful proposals, so it's been a really fun ride. He's also been a supporter of Skyway since the very beginning, so it's cool to have him on here. It's been a wild and exciting ride for both of us as we've grown our companies over the last several years. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Garth Arevalo. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here. I've enjoyed the podcast in the past, and I am looking forward to talking to you today, Kevin.
So tell me a little bit about your experience as a contracting officer, so people know what you did when you were a CO.
I was an Air Force active duty contracting officer. I started my career in the Air Force as a contracting officer and had a variety of different experiences. Started out at the base level. I was stationed in Japan, where I was in charge of the commodities flight. We were responsible for buying all the supplies and small services for throughout the base. Then I followed that on with a couple of assignments buying space systems, bought some weather satellites and other kinds of major programs, did major source selections for systems level contracting. Then I moved on to support the special operations community in more of a contingency contracting role, where I was responsible for contracting support to special operations forces, mostly deployed as they were fighting in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other places in the Middle East.
So you started out with the small stuff, with small, more rapid transactions, and also worked at the other end of the extreme with large satellite systems. And in between those, you've got this unique experience as what's called a contingency contracting officer. So tell us more about that.
So there are obviously many of the contracting officers that you may deal with are civil service, but there's also a good amount of military, and that actually has grown since 9/11. The different services had military contracting officers, and their role was to support the forces as they move forward to go overseas, to be support the force as they're going to battle, as they're working on exercises, training, or a variety of different situations. So military contracting officers are contracting officers just like civilian ones, but they also have to be prepared and they have to fight alongside the major force. Contingency contracting officers buy everything from construction to small supplies. They'll work, walk the streets and find supplies or companies, whether it be in the local area. And it really helps the logistics trail because if you can buy something locally, that means that item didn't need to get shipped from, you know, from the U.S. So contingency contracting officers can be a real force multiplier for the military forces deployed.
So what's the coolest thing you bought as a contingency contracting officer in some random location?
We helped we bought the uniforms for the Iraqi Special Forces. So that was pretty interesting. And they wanted to have a distinctive uniform for their special unit. And that was a lot of fun because those guys had some very good success in fighting the bad guys in Iraq.
Very cool. Okay, switch gears. So in 2008, you leave your 12-year career from the active duty military and start Lukos. The first question is, so you and I both had the same scenario. We stopped halfway through our careers and started our own companies. And there's a kind of an understanding we get from a lot of people that say, you were halfway through a career with the government. You know, what caused you to switch? And I've answered that question for myself, but I was curious, what's your answer to that? What was the driver that got you to start Lukos?
Well, as a contracting officer, I had an opportunity to run industry days and meet with various companies. And it, I think it probably, I had one in particular where I ran an industry day and sat across the table with one-on-ones with small and large businesses. And I started meeting some of the small business owners that were there to talk to me and market their companies. And I realized that my experience as a contracting officer would be very valuable to starting a company. And there's a lot of great opportunities for small businesses in the federal marketplace. I saw that, and with always kind of an entrepreneurial spirit, I said, hey, I want to go out in there and use some of the skills that I used as a contracting officer and really believed in the military and the government missions. So I saw it as a different way to serve and use my business skills. So I was I had it in my head for a few years before I went ahead and did it, but I've been thrilled, and we've had a lot of success since we started Lukos.
Very cool. And you – if memory serves, we even got an MBA in entrepreneurship along the way for that.
Yeah, I went to USF and got a master's in entrepreneurship, and I'd actually already been running Lukos for a little while, but got a degree along the way to use my GI Bill to great benefit from being in the military, but to learn a little bit more about starting and running a business.
And for those of you who don't know, who aren't local to Tampa, USF is a University of Southern Florida, just FYI.
Although it's in Tampa, not too southern.
That's a good point. So here's a really fun topic we kicked around. What would be a really great thing for Garth to kind of help us understand? One of them was the three things that he wished he knew when he was a contracting officer. So that's, we're going to go through these three things, and it's an interesting conversation we had prepping for this, and I'll let you go. What's the first one that really jumps out at you that you wish you knew back when you were a CO?
Sure. Contracting officers, when they're trying to get the word out about contracts, whether it be you know, early stage or to put the RFP on the street, they'll use federal business opportunities, FedBizOps. And when I was a contracting officer, I used that. But and oftentimes, contracting officers use FBO for market research, and market research is a big thing for contracting officers to try to make good decisions and understand what industry is capable of. So they'll use FBO to get the word out and try to get information back. What I didn't realize is what the impact was, and when an FBO is posted, what's the cascading activity from industry? What does industry do? How do they react to an FBO notice, in whether it be very early in the stage, late in the stage, things like that? I didn't know what happened behind the scenes. There is a cost of doing business in when you're supporting the government and just maintaining responsiveness to different things. But it's really there is a whole lot of business decisions that are made just from a simple FBO post. And I think the average contracting officer may not realize that they have set in motion maybe a set of teaming situations because maybe companies for the first time they've heard about it is on FBO. Or an FBO is an indicator that there's an RFP coming. So companies are really trying to get ahead of and trying to be prepared for RFPs. So when you put out an FBO notice and it just was for information and then nothing becomes of it, you've cost those companies a lot of money. There's I'm sure a bunch of companies have reviewed it. Many of them have made maybe, you know, a handful to dozens of meetings to be prepared for the upcoming opportunity. There are some agencies that do a better job of interacting with industry through FBO and other communication methods. But it's important for contracting officers to understand that when they do put something out, they're costing industry money, that the industry is going to react to pretty much just every FBO notice, small or large. The larger ones obviously will get more attention. But we recently had an RFI from an agency that came out, and they had an industry day. I traveled up to Virginia to go to that industry day, and they got there and they let everyone know at the industry day that the requirement was for all of three people. And there was about 40 or 50 companies. They actually had to do an overflow room of companies that were there for the industry day. And as soon as they put up the second slides showing the size of the opportunity, there was a big kind of, everyone really was,
the air left the room.
Yeah, the air left the room was, we came up here. I mean, you had, let's say 20 companies, traveled from out of area to come to this industry day for a very small requirement. I mean, Lucos, I'm glad I went, but a lot of companies would not have spent the money. They wouldn't have had put the time, they put travel money and the opportunity cost of responding and attending this industry day. By putting some of that information out ahead of time, you are taking a lot of action. And as this one notification showed, we had this industry day with a ton of interest and a lot of money expended where you didn't really know what was going on. So you have to be conscious of the impacts that you are having on industry when you put out FBO notices.
Yeah, and I got to say, that's something I didn't think of that clearly until we really kicked this around as a topic, because there are lots of things that I would put out on FBO thinking I was saving people time, and I might be, but I'm causing this cascading effect. It's not something that's normally going to think of as a contracting officer. That's a good one. Okay, so what's your second one?
Communication is obviously really important, and industry really thrives on communications. Clearly, contracting officers need to be fair. They want to try, especially as you get close to or during a source selection, they want to make sure that companies are treated fairly and information comes out in a pretty transparent manner. But sometimes that has gotten, I think what I've found is the government agencies have gone to the other side of that communication spectrum. Oh, well, they may say that we're in the middle of a source selection, so we can't talk to anyone. Well, industry is trying to plan, especially if they bid on a contract. They may be preparing their management team. They may be making hires or not, making hires. There may be, as things drag on, people may be let go because things have gone too long. So letting industry know what's happening, particularly during a long and drawn out source selection process, is really important. And it could be as simple as saying, we've finished evaluations, we're moving to the next phase. So during that time, industry just sits there in the dark. And being able to, whether it be post on FBO to say, this is the latest thing that's going on, here's where we are, it lets companies prepare. And then that, I think, ends up benefiting the government, because then their bidders are more prepared for the next phase. They'd be prepared for discussions if you're going to start discussions. They were going to be more prepared for contract execution.
That's a really good point from the perspective of knowing where we are in the cycle. If you're waiting to find out if you want a contract or not, it's one thing to find out the night before that discussions are going to happen. By the way, you're getting invited to come, go buy a plane ticket and come here for discussions, versus if you found out like 2 weeks earlier, we're concluding discussions, you should know something in the next couple of weeks. That little piece of information, which you can easily put on FBO. And again, I didn't think of that as a contracting officer. I was thinking, oh, they'll be fine. They'll figure it out when I call, which they can, but we're also making this business harder by doing it that way. So that's a fun one too.
Yeah, it really stinks to be in the dark. And, you can still be fair while communicating at the same time.
So what's your third one? That's a good one. What's the third thing you wish you knew as a contracting officer?
In our business, we run a services-based business, professional services. But the same thing I think works also for products. But teaming is so much a part of the federal landscape. We almost never bid a contract by ourselves. We'll always have someone to team with, whether we're the subcontractor or the prime contractor. We pretty much are always going to work with some other company that complements us. And that whole how companies team up, what is the process for that, is something that was complete. I just had no real insight into, and I don't see a lot of government contracting officers really seeing what is the – how does the teaming process work? What do the decisions make, or how do they make the decisions, and who gets on? And also as a small business, I really didn't know once I got into started Lucos, why would a large business pick me as a small business? What were the things that made me attractive to support a large business? Why would they pick me as a teammate versus someone else?
So how does Section L&M, as far as being in a draft RFP, does that impact the overall team when you're putting your teams together?
Yeah, so to go along with that, I think there could be a lot of interesting ways to work with L&M, and obviously each RFP is going to pick an L&M that the government thinks is going to result in the right kind of proposal that they're looking for. But little things can have a big impact. For example, when you put in the number of past performance citations that you might be requiring for a proposal, that could drive how many teammates there are. The way small and large businesses work generally is they try to examine the performance work statement of work, whatever the document is. They'll usually break that down into the different areas that the government's looking for. Or if you're building a plane, it would be the same thing. You're breaking down the requirements. And rarely does a company have the capability of doing every single thing that is in the performance work statement. So what teams will do is they'll break down that performance work statement and identify all the different areas that they are that they need. And so if that company can cover down on, let's say, 3 of the 5 requirements, they're going to look for teammates that can fill in the other 2. And also, if you're a large business, you're looking for small businesses that have complementary capabilities in the areas for that particular acquisition. And to go along with that, you want to be able to provide past performance references that would go along with, let's say, those 5 areas. So you'd want to find teammates that could provide past performance citations in those work areas. So if you're the prime contractor and you have that experience in the first 3 of the 5 requirements, you're going to ask your teammates to come forward and tell us about the work that they've done, and then they would try to bring in citations that match up and give a full compliment, a full explanation of how the team has come together, and across the capabilities of the team, you can address all the government's requirements. So if you just ask for 3 citations, you might, as a company, say, I only need a couple of teammates. If you ask for 10, you might need to get a much larger team to address all the different requirements and also just to find 10 citations. So just like you would expect, if they ask for 10, even if they said anywhere between 5 and 10, you can assume competitive companies are going to submit 10. They want to look as good as possible. Little decisions like that are worth maybe discussing during an industry day. I understand they oftentimes want to have broad performance work statements and that cover down on a lot of different requirements, but realize that the industry is going to break down that performance work statement and try to make sure that they're covering all of those things. So all these things go into the business development and teaming process.
Interesting. So when another one of those things I never thought about as a contracting officer, when writing the number of citations into Section L, and the impact, the cascading impact that has on industry. And of course, now I see it, now that we're on this side. But yeah, that's a great example. That's why it's so much fun to have Garth on here.
Okay, that's it for part 1 of Kevin's interview with Garth Arevalo. In next week's part 2, the focus will be more on teaming and subcontracting experiences. Thanks for joining us today. And don't forget to tell a friend about the Contracting Officer Podcast. Remember, if you need help with the government market, join the Skyway Connection community at skywayacquisition.com/connect. And as always, if you have questions, comments, or complaints, send me an email at paul@contractingofficerpodcast.com. Thanks for joining us.